Welcome to the Liberty Education Interview Series. Today we're going to be talking to Robert L. Woodson, Sr., founder of the Woodson Center, which helps people in low-income neighborhoods address the problems of their communities. Robert Woodson is also former head of the National Urban League Department of Criminal Justice and had been a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Foundation for Public Policy Research. He is a MacArthur Genius Awardee and recipient of the 2008 Bradley Prize, the Presidential Citizens Award, and a 2008 Social Entrepreneurship Award from the Manhattan Institute. Robert, thanks so much for joining us today.
I'm pleased to be here.
You've talked a great deal about so-called sensitivity trainers and their lectures about such things as equity, cultural appropriation, and racial relevance. Explain why you refer to these trainers as representatives of the race grievance industry and why you believe they do more harm than good.
Well, first of all, I'm a veteran of the civil rights movement, having led demonstrations in the 60s. And we were fighting for inclusion into America, not exclusion. And also, the goal was equal opportunity. And also, as you know, Dr. King said, we need to be judged by the content of our character, not the color of our skin. And so those were the principles that we fought for. But what has happened over the last 50 years, the civil rights movement, unfortunately, has been perverted and is now a race grievance industry. Rather than seeking reconciliation and integration, they're seeking separation and tribalism. And so I really think that the race grievance industry obliterates the individuals, but looks at everybody as either a part of an oppressor or an aggrieved group. And that is destroying this country.
And in the same vein, explain to our listeners why you believe colleges are wrong to promote the idea that any disparity in performance or representation must be because of racism.
Well, it's just, again, it's a major contradiction. Disparity unto itself does not automatically translate into injustice. I make the point all the time that young people, particularly black kids, are disproportionately represented in those that are suspended and not performing as well academically. But they're also disproportionately represented in varsity sports. Black men, for instance, are only 9% of the population, but they comprise about 75% of the players in the NFL. Now, is it how, you can't have it both ways. If disparity is an indication of social injustice, then why are blacks overrepresented in one place and under in another? So obviously it cannot be injustice that explains every form of disparity.
Now, I guess closely related to that would be that you said black youngsters would actually be harmed by reparations, which is a hot topic right now, and even though they'd be the supposed beneficiaries of the program. Explain exactly how you believe they'd be harmed.
Well, first of all, even the entire discussion, if somebody steals something from someone else and they are still around, yes, you can seek to remedy that by demanding that they pay them back. But when something happened 150 years ago, to talk about somehow you can erase or injustice by some kind of monetary compensation, it's such a complicated issue. First of all, there were a small number of blacks who owned slaves themselves, free blacks. Now, do the descendants of those free blacks who are slave owners, do they pay reparations? What about the whites who came here after slavery ended from Eastern Europe and Southern Europe? Are they exempt? What about the hundreds of thousands who died, who never owned slaves, who died fighting against slavery? It gets into a very complicated, but I think that even the whole discussion is a distraction. You always have to start with what does the end look like? What is the solution? Whenever I get into this protracted debate, I ask the people who support reparations, tell me one problem it would solve. And they can't answer that. It's wasting energy, and it also divides us. It it assumes that there only can be winners and losers, that they're victims and victimizers. And America is just not that.
Another related topic, you've said that a wealthy person buying his or her child's way into college and the agenda of the race grievance industry are two sides of the same coin. I thought that was kind of fascinating. What's your reasoning behind this?
Well, I think any time you promote a program, an attitude of entitlement, and that is wealthy children can assume that they don't have to work hard or have a good attitude or righteous behavior in order to get ahead. That they believe that the answers to the opportunities, therefore, are created for them because they feel they're entitled to it. So entitlement attitude can come from a wealthy parent. From my friend Richard Watts, who's a lawyer in Orange County, has a very important book. It's called Fables of Fortune, What Rich People Have That You Don't Want. And his sequel to that is Entitlemania, when he talks about how crippling it is for wealthy kids to believe that they don't have to work hard because their parents are rich. The other side of it is low-income families, because of the government welfare programs, they too can grow up believing because they are a minority, because they're black, because they're Hispanic, and because of past injustices, therefore they have a right. They are entitled to certain advantages and certain opportunities. Both attitudes, both with the low-income and upper-income, an entitlement mentality is destructive because it discourages the individual from working hard and pursuing self-sufficiency and independence.
Robert, do you believe there's a link between our skyrocketing suicide rates and parents and schools trying to protect children from disappointment and failure?
Absolutely. It's a part of that whole other thing we just talked about, entitlement. I mean, first of all, there's a moral and spiritual crisis in America where people are being robbed of a feeling of content and meaning to your life. When Cain slew Abel in the Bible, God could have just sentenced him to death, but he had sentenced him to something far worse, and that is he was cursed to wander the earth without content or purpose in your life. And that's why I think people commit suicide. It's very interesting that in Silicon Valley, in Palo Alto, California, where you have 90% of the households are two parents with master's degrees and $170,000 incomes, but the suicide rate among these teenagers is six times the national average. And drug addiction among upper-income people is soaring as well. So obviously, just having things, just having money, is not enough. That there is a moral and spiritual crisis in America that hole cannot be filled with things, nor can it be filled with therapy. I just think we just need to return to godly values. We need to look to God. I just happen to be a Christian. I believe you find it in Christ. But it's something that we need to just acknowledge that suicide is not going to be solved by talking about rearranging secular options that people have. People have to learn to live not just for themselves, but for someone else. I've heard of successful people committing suicide, but I've never heard of a happy person commit suicide.
I'd be curious to know, based on everything you've said up to now, how you feel about the whole Colin Kaepernick thing, and how does he fit in? Do you think it's dangerous that he's being held up as a role model for young black kids?
Well, I think it's horrendous that some spoiled, rich athlete who's been pampered all of his life is being given an opportunity to influence how a corporation spends its money And the message to young people is damaging to them, that somehow he has not really defined what it is that he's opposing. Racial injustice. What do you mean? What specifically is he targeting? He has never said that. And for somehow to denigrate the symbols of this country's freedom is just damaging to young people. I was coming through the airport last year when about 90 to 100 of our veterans of the Second World War were coming to the War Memorial, and I just had to go off in the corner and weep. When I think about the sacrifices that people like this have made for our freedoms here, every young person should, like Kaepernick, instead of watching Kaepernick take a knee, they should watch some of these documentaries about the war and how people gave up their lives for these freedoms. Rather than watching Kaepernick take a knee, they should watch how some of our men in the Second World War gave their lives for these freedoms. I think it should be mandatory that they watch some of these documentaries so we can get a sense of what people have done that made it possible for Kaepernick to take a knee.
The Betsy Ross flag had nothing whatsoever to do with race or slavery or anything. Would you agree to that?
No, I totally agree. But I just think that both Kaepernick and Nike made an economic decision. I really think it's just crass exploitation of a situation. Both of them, he's making more money now than he ever would have made in the NFL. A 31-year-old pampered athlete, been pampered all of his life, and somehow he's a symbol, he's a social justice warrior. Maybe he ought to explain to young people how he became successful in the presence of these conditions.
Robert, what was your take on Donald Trump's referring to Baltimore as a quote-unquote rat and rodent-infested mess? Do you believe his words were racist?
No, I don't think they're racist, but I described them in a column that I wrote, rude, crude, and true. And so I just think, though, that I wish he had not generalized about all people in Baltimore. And also, I wish he would just discipline his language a little bit so it's less crude. And I would not have personalized it to Elijah Cummings, the congressman. I think any time you launch a personal attack on someone, it lets them off the hook. But something happened that in Baltimore, and I know Baltimore, and the conditions that he talked about in West Baltimore is true. Those conditions exist, despite the fact in the last 4 years, millions and millions have been poured in without success. And it was very interesting that 2 weeks ago, a white Trump supporter led a group of 100 volunteers, and they were joined by 200 others. And they actually came in and went on the streets and in 24 hours cleared away 14 tons of trash. And they were supported by and welcomed by black residents of the neighborhood who pitched in and helped as well. But you don't get much attention to that. And the young man who organized it said he was not doing this for the president. He was doing it to help these fellow Americans. Nor was he doing it to denigrate Elijah Cummings, the congressman. He said, we were doing this, Americans helping Americans, and that's how it was received on the streets. But it did not lead in the news. You probably didn't even hear about it.
Back to Donald Trump on racism. If you were assigned the task, Robert, of whitewashing Donald Trump's reputation as a racist, how would you go about it? What advice would you give? What would you do?
Well, first of all, I would go, like this volunteer of his, I would go around the gatekeepers, and I would support efforts on the part of the people living in those neighborhoods to help themselves. I would provide direct support, just like this volunteer went in. They cleaned out alleys and streets that were strewn with trash. And I would do this all over this country. I would not stop at the doors of these bureaucrats. I would go into the neighborhoods. The Whitson Center has about we've trained about 3,000 grassroots leaders of all different racial and ethnic groups in 39 states. And so we have a whole roster of grassroots social entrepreneurs, we call them, who are in these drug-infested, crime-ridden neighborhoods, who are taking personal responsibility for promoting redemption and transformation of individuals and the redevelopment of those communities. If I were to say to the president, take your staff and go to, and also take some of those wealthy funders who are writing checks to PACs and instead write checks to grassroots leaders that are in these communities. There was one Republican that we don't really read about. His name was Dick Reardon. Back in 1990, Dick Reardon's a conservative businessman. He went into East L.A., which is a low-income black Hispanic community, and for 2 years, he worked with local leaders, most of them were Democrats, and he built a state-of-the-art after-school facility called the Reardon Center. And then he declared his candidacy for the mayor. He was the first Republican in 35 years to become the mayor of Los Angeles. Because, and then when he got reelected, he was reelected with 60% of the votes of every demographic. So Dick Reardon demonstrated what the president should and other Republicans can do, and that is go around the gatekeepers, go into the communities, partner with some of the grassroots leaders, invite your friends to come in and invest, because if you plant charitably, you can harvest politically, but you cannot harvest and plant in the same year. So there's Steve Goldsmith, the mayor, the former mayor of Indianapolis, he did the same thing. He got reelected. For 6 years, the Woodson Center worked with Steve Goldsmith, and what he did was he privatized public services and allowed local black churches to actually manage some of the city's parks, hiring young people from the neighborhood, and so they gained a sense of ownership of that park, so the parks were maintained, they were safe. It just takes a little imagination to employ people. He transformed some of the most drug-ridden, crime-ridden neighborhoods into some of the most prosperous places. So again, the theme is go around the bureaucrats, go around the mayor's office and say, go in directly to the community and work with and partner with grassroots leaders in there.
If Donald Trump went into the inner cities, the south side of Chicago, the west side, Baltimore, St. Louis, et cetera, and talked to the people and actually did rallies there, I truly believe he could win 50% or more of the black vote, because African Americans, it's been my experience, are generally speaking, are conservative by in nature.
They are. And there's a contemporary example of what you're saying. DeSantis ran against Gillum for the governor of Florida. Now, Gillum was black, supported by Oprah Winfrey and campaign, and Obama, President Obama came to campaign for them. But DeSantis was elected with 32,000 votes. 100,000 low-income black parents split their vote and voted for DeSantis because he was a strong supporter of vouchers, and Gillum was an opponent of vouchers. So the black community voted against Oprah and voted against Obama. I think DeSantis got 18% of the black vote statewide, because blacks here demonstrated that they're willing to vote issues if Republicans would just give them a chance to vote on those issues.
Now, speaking of Democrats, what do you think the chances are that the radical left and the Democratic Party will ultimately succeed in bringing socialism to America?
I don't think there's any appetite for socialism in America in these communities. Once people get to know what that means, and right now the polls are indicating, that's like in the 30s, when communism tried to make inroads into the black community, they were not successful at all, even though blacks were suffering under racism and Jim Crow. And that is because socialism and communism was anti-God, and the black community is still anchored in their Christian faith. And so I think once it's been determined that that it's a way of easing God out, I don't think that the black community would be accessible to be recruited and to embrace socialism. I just don't believe it. That strong tradition that helped us get through oppression of those oppressive times, I don't think we're going to abandon those now.
And speaking of Democrats, how concerned are you about the violence that's coming from the radical left, and how do you think all this violent behavior will ultimately end? Where do you think they're going with this?
Well, I really think that we've got to give people who are being hurt most about it an opportunity to speak for themselves. I mean, it's what's scary about the mayor of Portland, Oregon, allows Antifa, that radical leftist, to go undisciplined and unpoliced and beat up people. It's very dangerous when government takes the side in a political situation like that. So that's very dangerous. But I think that we have to be vigilant and fight against extremism, whether it's left or right. We really do.
Speaking of violence, as you know, there's a heated debate over the causes of mass shootings. Happens every time there is a mass shooting. And liberals want to blame it all on Donald Trump and take away our guns, and conservatives blame it on violent movies and video games and mental health problems. So, Robert, if you were in charge of coming up with a solution to gun violence, what would you propose?
Well, first of all, I'd stop calling it gun violence. I mean, in Great Britain, the big problem over there is people are being killed with knives. As long as we keep calling it gun violence, we assume the problem is the presence of guns, and that's not the issue. The issue is the attitudes, the feelings, going back to what I said earlier, the feeling of emptiness and loneliness that I think. Some years ago, they did a study of the 38 youthful killers to find out what is it if they had any common profile, and they found that they didn't have any common personal profile, but what they all had in common is that they told someone what they were going to do before they did it. And so I really think that we are not tuned into the networks of kids. And we have had a small demonstration. When you recruit young adults to serve as moral mentors and character coaches to other young people, then they will be in a position of reading social media, and we can get some early warnings. But we've got to come up with something that begins to reach into the culture of youth and let healthy elements there give us some early warnings as to what. That is something that I don't hear discussed at all. The Woodson Center has a program called Violence Free Zone, where we were able to stop violence, reduce it in schools, particularly in Milwaukee, where we recruit young students, maybe 5 or 6 years older than the students, and they are paid as monitors in those schools and in communities, and so they are much more willing to report aberrant behavior to another peer than they would an adult. So it's something that I really think the country needs to take a look at.
And two last questions. I'm always amazed that Democrats are so determined to block all efforts to check voter identification, basically to require that a voter show clear evidence that he is who he says he is. Sounds reasonable to me. They insist that requiring proof of voter ID is really voter suppression. Do you believe that requiring voters to have proper identification is voter suppression?
No, absolutely not. I think it's ridiculous. I mean, if you're going to anywhere, get on a plane, if you go to the White House or any place, you got to show ID. I don't think some of these civil justice warriors are missing is that the biggest vote of suppression is apathy. In low-income black neighborhoods around the country, like Washington, D.C., at our last mayor's election, in those two high-crime wards, the voter turnout was 6%. And if you go to the most major cities that are represented by black officials, particularly congressional officials, you will see the turnout rates are all under 10, all under 15%. So apathy is the greatest suppression of votes than voter IDs.
Lastly, Robert, what is your take on the 2020 Democratic presidential field? And in conjunction with this, what do you think the results of the 2020 elections will be for the presidency, the House, and the Senate?
You don't ask small questions.
No, that's not small. That's not small.
I'm as clueless as most Americans are. I just think things are in such turmoil now that President Trump has turned the tables over in the temple, and the money changers are scrambling, and it's just going to be very difficult to determine. But I don't think that we are going to vote for any candidate that defines their platform as having to be socialist. I can tell you will not prevail, and that a socialism will not prevail in this next election.
Robert, I want to thank you for joining us today and sharing your excellent insights with us, and I wish you continued success with the Woodson Center and all your other endeavors.
Thank you so much.